What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Hollifield, and joining me at the roundtable are students from the Millicent Hollifield Academy of Health Sciences at Rickards High School. The academy is designed to prepare high school students for entry into collegiate studies of pre-medicine, allied health sciences, pharmacy, public health, and more. And a special welcome to Dr. Ron Saff from the Allergy and Asthma Diagnostic Treatment Center. Dr. Saff is board certified in allergy and immunology and internal medicine. He is a clinical assistant professor at Florida State University College of Medicine. Joining me here at the roundtable, I welcome Leonard Lindsay. Leonard is a sophomore, and Leonard is into health, technology, neurology, first response, psychology. He's got it all covered. Leonard, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
I'm glad to have you. Chad Allen. Chad is in the ninth grade. He's interested in pharmacy, nurse, and ophthalmology.
Hey, it's nice to be here.
Alicia Hampton. Alicia is in the 11th grade, and she is into developmental child psychology.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
Right on. Shai Roberts. Shai is in the 11th grade. Her thing is social work, and she's interested in being a paramedic.
I'm glad to be here.
Julia Fountain. Julia is into physical therapy and forensics, and she's a junior.
Hi, nice to be here.
And Melisha Larry. Melisha is a junior. Her interests are she wants to be a pediatric nurse, and she's into doing hair.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
Well, I'm glad to have all of you. And again, a special, special welcome to Dr. Ron Saff.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for coming. The incidence of asthma is rapidly increasing in the United States. Reports indicate it's affecting up to 1 in 4 children. Asthma is a chronic or recurring disease of the respiratory system. The airways may constrict, become inflamed, and lined with excessive amounts of mucus. The symptoms can range from mild to life-threatening. Acute episodes may be triggered by cold air, exercise, exertion, exposure to environmental stimulants, stress, viral illnesses. There's no cure, but often asthma can be controlled with a combination of drugs and environmental changes. Dr. Saff is going to share with us and entertain any of the questions that you all may have about asthma. Dr. Saff, before we really get into the discussion, would you elaborate some more on just what is going on with asthma and allergies, too, because I know sometimes they kind of go hand in hand?
Asthma is a disease of the airways, and what we have is our lungs are made up of all these bronchial tubes, and our bronchial tubes are surrounded by muscle bands, and these muscle bands go around the bronchial tubes in much the same way a rubber band would. And when people have asthma, what happens is that these muscle fibers constrict. They constrict and the hole of the airway gets very small, so it becomes difficult for people to breathe. When you try to move air out of a very small airway, it's kind of like breathing through a straw. People cough, wheeze, they get out of breath. And so what's happening are that the muscles are spasmed down, but additionally there's all the inflammation and the redness. The lungs are sort of inflamed. The lungs are sort of on fire. The medications that we use to treat asthma are medications that open up the bronchial tubes and also medications called inhaled corticosteroids, which decrease the inflammation or decrease the fire in the lung. So when we get patients under good control, most seem to do pretty well. And although there's no cures for asthma, most people can expect to lead a healthy, normal lifespan and participate in the full range of sports and can participate in all of life's activities.
Well, I have some questions. Now, I know we have some folks that have asthma, so feel free to ask. But how do you get it?
We don't know 100% for sure why people have asthma, but there's a strong genetic component. So, for instance, if mom and dad have asthma, well, there's a good chance that the son or daughter will have asthma. If just one parent has it, then the chance of developing asthma in the child is less, but it's still there. So there's a strong, very strong genetic component. Additionally, we think that in conjunction with having a strong genetic component, exposure to certain allergens at a very young age can cause the development of asthma. So there's a lot of research now that's going into people who are exposed to dust mites, which are little microscopic creatures that live in our bedding. And it seems that if you have the genetic component coupled with exposure to allergen at the right age, then the lungs will become inflamed and develop asthma. There's also some recent research that shows that it may be things just as simple as mom having a cold during pregnancy. So we don't know 100% why that would occur. Some people think it may be due to the Tylenol that perhaps mom ingests to combat the cold. But having colds during pregnancy is a risk factor for the child to have asthma. Additionally, kids that are born through a C-section have higher rates of asthma than kids that are born through standard vaginal deliveries. And that may be related to when the baby comes through the birth canal, the baby ingests certain bacteria that's in the mom's birth canal. And that bacteria sort of colonize the gut, and the gut tickles the immune system in the right way to promote immunity rather than allergy. So complicated answer. You know, we really don't know. Sometimes it's just having a bad virus. Some people can be fine, healthy as can be, no parental history of asthma. They develop a certain type of virus, and the virus goes away. They have some coughing, wheezing, the virus leaves, and then the patient has asthma for the rest of their life.
So what I hear you saying is that one can develop asthma over any period of their life, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
When children develop asthma, there's a tendency for them to outgrow it later on in life. So classically, we see small kids and they have asthma, it gets worse, and then it kind of goes away in their 20s, 30s. That's opposed to the adult onset asthma. So in other words, some people grow up, no history of childhood asthma. They develop asthma perhaps as a virus in adulthood, and that one has a tendency to just progressively worsen and not go away.
Questions? Feel free.
What causes children to outgrow asthma?
We just don't know what causes it, why people sort of get bad and have severe asthma attacks versus outgrow it. We just don't know. It seems to be the natural progression of the condition. We know that if kids are exposed to things that they're allergic to, so for instance, I had a patient the other day who's allergic to cats, and his wife loves cats. She has four of them. And then she just got another one. And his asthma is getting really, really bad. And he was in the emergency room recently. He likes the cats. His wife loves the cats. Getting rid of the cats is not an option. Most people would rather get rid of their allergists than get rid of the pets that they love. But we'll expect his asthma to likely worsen rather than improve.
By having severe allergies, can that cause you to gain asthma in the future?
Having allergies is a risk factor. So in Tallahassee, we see a lot of dust mite allergies. So dust mites are little microscopic creatures that live in our bedding, and they live where the humidity is high. And all across the southeast here, the humidity is very high, and that promotes dust mite growth. Dust mites live in our bedding, and the reason they're in our bedding is we as humans, we shed, and little bits of our skin flakes come off, and they use that as their food supply. And so there's millions and millions and millions of them in our bedding. Of course, we can't see them, fortunately. And it's thought that exposure to very high levels of dust mites in early childhood is a risk factor for the development of asthma. Now, in Arizona, there's like no dust mites. And the reason is it's a dry environment as opposed to here where it's humid. There it's extremely dry. There's not high humidity that like we see here. There's low humidity and dust mites aren't a problem. The people in Arizona, they don't have that as an issue. But here in the Southeast, dust mites are endemic. And nearly everybody who comes into my practice is allergic to dust mites. And again, that's a very strong risk factor for the development of asthma later on.
So who's more vulnerable to asthma or allergies age-wise?
Well, asthma and allergies can come on, you know, any time. But usually my practice is, you know, children, teenagers, college kids. It's a younger crowd. I usually don't see people in their 60s or 70s. Certainly there's allergies and asthma at that age. But it seems to not be as severe. And generally, asthma and allergies is kind of a younger adults or a pediatric condition rather than a geriatric condition.
Why does one medicine work better than the other versus the other?
Well, there's different types of medications to treat asthma. When we talk about asthma, the bronchial tubes constrict, so the muscles spasm down. And it's like a rubber band just getting tighter and tighter and tighter. And then it's like breathing through a pinhole. People are struggling to breathe. We call that bronchospasm. And the medications that are used to treat that, they carry the names of ProAir or Ventolin or Albuterol. And they all are equally as efficacious to treat asthma. They all work pretty good to open up the bronchial tubes. There's other medications that we use to treat the inflammation. Remember, the lungs are hot and red and swollen and inflamed. If you've ever had like an ant bite on your skin or an insect bite on your skin becomes red and hot and swollen. And that's what's kind of going on inside the lungs. And the medications used to treat that are called inhaled corticosteroids. They're fire extinguishers. It's like if you have an ant bite and your skin gets red, you put on some cortisone. Well, if your lungs are inflamed and you have asthma, you inhale the cortisone. We call those inhaled corticosteroids. And those work extremely well too. So, you know, the medications work very well. The issue is, you know, some people don't take the medications.
Dr. Saf, let me interrupt you for 1 minute. We've got to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. On this edition of 411 Teen, we're talking with Dr. Ron Saf, allergist and certified clinical research investigator, certified physician investigator, and we have members of the Millicent Hollifield Health Academy at Rickards High School. Dr. Saf, I had to interrupt you, so will you continue?
Sure. So the medications work very well, but sometimes the patients don't work so well. They don't take their medications like they should. You know, generally speaking, most people – now, there's a lot of exceptions, of course, but most people, if they take their asthma medications, most do extremely well. You know, in the old days, you know, 20, 30 years ago, the medications had a lot of side effects and they weren't very strong and they weren't really targeted to where the inflammation is in the lungs. And there was all kinds of hospitalizations and people would really have to lead sedentary lives. They couldn't do sports or do activities because their asthma was so severe, and the medications just wasn't helping. But nowadays, the medications are really terrific, and they work exceptionally well. But the issue is, again, you know, compliance or adherence, and there's a variety of reasons why people don't take their medications. Some is cost. Some is forgetfulness. Some is, I don't need it, and what does that doctor know? So there's a whole variety of issues when it comes to taking or not taking medications.
Jalea, you have some questions? She was born with asthma.
Yes, I actually do have, I think, two questions. One of my questions is, well, I was a C-section baby, and I was born with asthma. And then I remember my freshman year, I saw an ad on the internet saying that they were doing research to see if C-sections can cause asthma, because I saw that, like, as a reoccurring theme. And I just wanted to know if you know anything about that, because that kind of relates to me.
Well, there's a whole wide world of research that's just opening up. And the gastroenterologists are really excited about this, because it may turn out that the gut is the most important system in our bodies. And let me give you some background information. When we're born through the birth canal, the baby naturally will ingest some of the bacteria from mom's birth canal, and that bacteria will go down into the baby's mouth and get swallowed, and it will colonize the gut. In other words, it will start growing in the large intestines and the small intestines. And the milieu, the environment from the birth canal and mom is generally, that's a healthy, favorable one. So we get all these good growing bacteria in the gut. And then through different receptors, the bacteria sort of tickle the body's immune system. And if the right bacteria are there and the baby goes through the birth canal, then it tickles the immune system to protect against asthma. It tickles the immune system to become immune from diseases and illnesses. So on the other hand, if the baby is born through a C-section, then the baby doesn't get that healthy gut bacteria. And the baby develops bacteria later on in their gut, but it may not be as healthy, and there may be sort of a crucial time when that immune system needs to be tickled by the bacteria and is not getting tickled in the right way. So, I mean, not only is this thought to be sort of the pathogenesis of asthma, but it's thought that a lot of diseases may be as a result from the right bacteria being in the right place at the right time when the baby comes out through the birth canal. And this whole field is just exploding. You know, 2-3 years ago, probiotics wasn't on anybody's agenda. Now everybody's taking probiotics. Right. And this is just such a hot area. You know, when I go to allergy conventions, they didn't talk about this 3-4 years ago, the bacteria that were present at birth. But now you hear lecture after lecture. And again, not just in my field, allergy and asthma, but in numerous fields, it's thought that this gut bacteria at birth plays such an important role.
Is it normal for you to get lightheaded or feel like you're about to fall after you have an asthma attack?
Well, that's not a classic symptom. The classic symptoms of asthma are, well, think what happens. The muscles start to spasm down and your lungs become red and hot and swollen, and you just can't get enough air in and out. So people are wheezing, they're coughing, they're short of breath, their chest is tight. When people start getting lightheaded, that can mean sort of an advanced asthma attack. Or what happens with some people is they develop a little touch of asthma and they start to panic, and then they start to hyperventilate. And that hyperventilation causes changes in the pH of the blood, and that can cause people to become lightheaded. So lightheaded, that's kind of one of the nonspecific symptoms. Lightheadedness can be a result from numerous different things, from having a low blood pressure to side effects of medication to hyperventilation. But classically, it really isn't that well associated with asthma exacerbations.
Well, when I take my Albuterol treatment, is there a reason why I start to shake, like either like during or after I take it?
Albuterol works to open up the muscles. With asthma, the muscles are swollen shut. It's the muscle fibers, the rubber bands are squeezing shut, squeezing those lungs closed. And through the pharmacologic side effects of albuterol, what albuterol does, and it goes by different names, albuterol, Ventolin, ProAir, what that does is it opens up the muscles. But the pharmacologic side effect is it causes people to become a little nervous and jittery. What I tell my patients is that when they take their albuterol, it's sometimes like it feels like drinking a cup or two of coffee very quickly. People will have some palpitations. They'll get a little nervous and jittery. Sometimes they'll get a tiny bit lightheaded. But that usually passes within 10, 15 minutes for most.
Does smoking increases your chance of getting asthma?
Oh, yes, yes. Smoking increases the chance of developing asthma. And, you know, in medical school, if they ask you, does smoking increase the chance, and they'll give you, like, a bunch of conditions, you know, brain cancer or diabetes, you name it. And the answer is always all of the above, you know. Smoking is such a bad actor that it causes the development of asthma. It when people have asthma and they smoke, they're a lot worse. And it's not just people who smoke. What we've now realized is that there's what we call secondhand smoke, which is, let's say, mom or dad is smoking inside the house with the child who has asthma. Well, that secondhand smoke is also a risk factor. So, for instance, people in restaurants that smoke, they're smoking inside restaurants, and there's people who have asthma who are breathing in the mm-hmm. smoke, and that can trigger asthma. Now, fortunately, the state of Florida, perhaps a decade ago, enacted laws that prevent smoking in workplaces and the restaurants. So, fortunately, people aren't exposed to that, but other states like Georgia is not so progressive, and you can just drive, you know, half hour up the road and sit down in a restaurant, a Waffle House in Georgia, and people are smoking like chimneys there. So it's kind of nice that we have, in that sense, a forward-looking state. There's also what we call third-hand smoke, which is mom and dad smoke, but they smoke outside the house, and that's also a risk factor for the child who has asthma, because what happens is all the carcinogens are put on the clothing. They kind of stick to the clothing. The parents go into the house, and all the carcinogens sort of fly off the clothing and into the child's airway. And that's a risk factor for all kinds of illness.
How would you treat someone who is going through an asthma attack?
Well, the treatment is with bronchodilators. So those medications open up the airways pretty quickly. In the office, we have a nebulizer, which means it's kind of like a peace pipe. It puts into a fine respiratory mist, and patients breathe in medication called Duoneb, which is two medications, albuterol, and it's coupled with this medication called ipratropium, which opens up the airways as well. It works on a nerve fiber to open up the airways. And so usually what we do is we want to check to see if the patient has enough oxygen. And if the patient doesn't have enough oxygen, then we treat with supplemental oxygen, usually through nasal prongs or through a face mask. So they get oxygen and bronchodilators, such as albuterol, through the nebulizer.
Is there any other way to keep your asthma under control without taking prescribed medications or being on an inhaler?
Well, generally speaking, people with severe asthma need to be on medications, and that will control their symptoms. But if you have mild asthma, let's say, and you're allergic to a cat, or, you know, you're allergic to grass, and generally you do real well, all you need to do is sort of avoid cats and, you know, stay away from mowing the grass. So generally speaking, mild asthmatics can be controlled without medications, but every asthmatic should carry their albuterol with them just in case they have a flare-up.
Have you ever had one of the medications not work or not?
You know, I see that reported in the literature, where sometimes the medication will plug up. But I've had maybe one or two patients over 19 years that have complained about it. But generally speaking, these inhalers work pretty well. And most patients, when they pull out their inhaler and they take their medication, it works and they get adequate relief.
Can you die from having asthma?
Yes. People die of asthma, sadly, every day in this country. It is, for the most part, preventable. The risk factors for dying of asthma are non-adherence with medications, patients who don't come in to their doctor's offices for their follow-up appointments, low education levels, lower socioeconomic group. These are sort of the risk factors for asthma mortality. And I just had an asthmatic patient, actually, just before I drove over here for the show. It was a 13-year-old kid, and her parents weren't ensuring that she was taking her – she was on an asthma medication called Advair. And if you rely on a teenager to take their asthma medication, you know, they're just – you know, they're not going to do it. You need – you know, I mean, a young teenager, you know, an older teenager, you know, college kids, you can pretty much rely on them to take their medication, hopefully. But it's the young teens, 12, 13s, you know, they need their parents to say, here's your medication, take your medication. It's a parental responsibility. So this child had a history of asthma attacks, hospitalizations, and emergency room visits. And despite repeated emergency room visits and hospitalizations, and despite the fact that I spoke to the parents on numerous occasions, they persisted in not giving the child the medication. So when I was evaluating the child today, the child was having an asthma attack, and I was asking Dad questions, and Dad was asleep. He like fell asleep. I'm asking him important questions, and he fell asleep. And then, like, in the middle of – yeah, it was really incredible. And then in the middle, he just, like, walks out of the room. When you're a parent, you got to stay with your kid. If the child is less than 18, you got to stay with your kid. He just left and drove off. Fortunately, he came back.
That would have been disheartening.
But, you know, that was really disheartening. So, you know, sadly, you know, this kid is at risk for, you know, a future an asthma attack. We call that morbidity or mortality. The child is at risk for dying of an asthma exacerbation. So, you know, sadly, you'd think that you'd talk to people and, you know, the parents would learn or the asthmatic would learn, but in my humble experience, rarely do people learn from their mistakes. They have a tendency to repeat their mistakes.
Mm-hmm. Is it easier or harder to give somebody CPR if they had asthma?
Generally, it's harder to give CPR if somebody has asthma. There's increased resistance in the airways. Fortunately, I haven't had to give any of my patients CPR, so I don't speak from personal experience. You know, I'm blessed in the fact that my office is in between two hospitals, and God forbid if somebody's having a severe asthma exacerbation in my office. The way we treat that, again, is with the breathing treatments, with supplemental oxygen. But if that doesn't improve the asthmatic symptoms, then you have to really admit the patient to the hospital. And what we do is we call the ambulance and they come over pretty quickly and they transport the patient to the hospital. So fortunately, I've never had to perform CPR in the office on somebody having an asthma attack.
Dr. Saffy, you go ahead. I can ask.
So when people have asthma attacks, what's really going on in their body?
Well, what's really going on in their body is that their lungs are inflamed and red and hot and swollen and full of mucus, and the bronchial tubes are all spasming down, and it's sort of like breathing through a pinhole. Mm. The airways are all red and just plugged up with mucus, and it's very hard to breathe. And you know, when that happens, you know, many people start to panic and they get anxious and they get nervous and they some patients, you know, they get that impending sense of doom. They say, "Oh my God, I think I'm going to die." Mm-hmm. And so that's what we see in the severe attacks that usually require emergency room visits or hospitalizations. But the milder ones, people can just get some mild to moderate wheezing or coughing or chest tightness, again, from the spasm and the inflammation in the lungs.
Dr. Saff, I was going to ask you, just what role does exercise play? I mean, it seems to trigger, you know, asthmatic attacks. And I've often read that athletes may be more susceptible to asthma. Is that true?
Well, yes, that is true. Exercise is a trigger for asthma, just like exposure to cat and a cat allergic patient is a trigger for asthma. What happens a lot of times that we see is asthma is more prevalent in certain types of athletes. So, for instance, we have Sochi going on, we have the Olympics going on, and those cold weather athletes that are are out skiing or snowboarding and they're exposed to that cold air, that seems to dry out the airways and prompt an asthma attack. The sports that seem to be better for asthmatics are where you're breathing the warm, humidified air. So swimming is in warm pools is such a wonderful exercise. And the athletes that have asthma, the ones that have it, you see very few swimmers as opposed to these cold winter sports athletes that have asthma. And if you watch the Olympics on TV, you'll likely see that a lot of these athletes do have asthma, and they use their inhaler before they do their routine or their sport. We know that to control exercise-induced asthma, there's a couple of things that do work, and that is high dosages of vitamin C. Ingesting fish oil helps. Warming up slowly helps. Using the albuterol, maybe 3 puffs, 30 minutes before, helps. And most athletes who do that do extremely well. You know, in the old days, 20, 30 years ago, doctors used to say, oh, my God, you know, you have asthma. Well, you know, I don't want you participating in sports and don't participate in sports at school. I want you to sit on the sideline. And nowadays, we say, well, you have asthma, and that's unfortunate. But, boy, take your medications and come in for your checkups and your visits. But for the majority of people, you know, there's no limitation. And now we have Olympic athletes that win the gold medal and they have asthma and they do just fine. Okay. So for the most part, we have, you know, no restrictions on most patients except take your medications, come in regularly for your appointments. And that's a huge challenge.
Hold your thoughts. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen, and we are having a dynamic program with Dr. Ron Saff, an allergist. Again, special thanks to Dr. Saff for coming and sharing all his expertise with his students who seem quite interested in what you have to say. Now, I have a question before you all get. I want to know, of course, you know, I'm going to ask you about stress and just what role stress plays in asthmatic attacks.
Stress plays a huge role. We know that children who are in stressful environments where the parents are going through a divorce or where there's not enough money to purchase adequate food, these kids are at high risk for developing major problems with their asthma. So stress is just a huge trigger of asthma. There's an interesting experiment that was done that it looked at the impacts of cigarette smoke. Now, everybody knows that cigarette smoke can trigger asthma. It happens very frequently. What the experimenters did was they took some cigarette smoke and they put it in a clear glass jar and they showed it to the asthmatic patient. And that patient developed an asthma attack just thinking, oh, my God, you know, there's smoke. And just the whole stress response to seeing smoke but not actually breathing it in precipitated an asthma attack. So really when you're treating asthmatic patients, you got to address the stress issue. And, oh, boy, you know, stress medication nowadays is there's a lot of people that are taking SSRIs, which is, you know, the Prozac type of medication, and stress just seems to be endemic in our society. And since I've been in practice, I just see more and more patients that are being treated with chronic stress relievers, Xanax, Prozac, and medications in that family.
Okay. If one of my friends were to get an allergy shot, like how long do those last and like what are they all about?
So allergy shots are a way to build up the body's immune system. When we were children, we got vaccinated or immunized to things like diphtheria, polio, and tetanus. And what that did was it built up our immune response so that we didn't come down with diphtheria or polio or these horrible medical conditions. because we are protected or vaccinated. And that's what allergy shots do. So what we do is we skin test the patient to find out what they're allergic to. So let's say the patient's allergic to cat and oak pollen and ragweed and Bermuda grass. And what we do is we prepare allergy extracts of those compounds that the patient is allergic to, and we give it to them in tiny doses. Allergy shots or allergy vaccinations are usually given over 4 years. In my office, and there's many different permutations of how it's done. I do it sort of the old-fashioned standard way, which is I give weekly injections for the first year, then once every 2 weeks for the second year, once every 3 weeks for the third year, and then once a month for the fourth year. And with allergy shots, it's building up the patient's immune system so the patient has better control of their allergies. There's less sniffly, less sneezy, less itchy, watery eyes. Their asthma is put under better control. And generally, the improvement occurs within several weeks. But it is a series of injections over 4 years. And patients have to be pretty diligent about coming in and getting their allergy shot on a regular basis for it to work.
How do you know the difference between an asthma attack and a panic attack?
That can be tough. A panic attack and an asthma attack, that, usually when you listen to an asthmatic, you'll hear wheezing classically. You'll hear that. And with a panic attack, usually you don't hear the wheezing. And after a while, after you've been, out in the field, and if you're a doctor and, you've been doing this for a while and you can kind of pick up the difference between an asthma attack and a panic attack pretty easily. Usually patients with panic attacks, they have a history of stress issues. They've been treated with stress-relieving medications. And there's other signs of a panic attack. They're tremulous and, they have palpitations. And quite honestly, they say, oh, I think I'm having a panic attack. So it's a little hard when you don't know the patient well. But after you establish a relationship with the patient, you can tell pretty easily.
Dr. Saff, is there a correlation between class and race as far as asthma is concerned? Because I think about asthma and it being higher among low-income populations. And I would also think that environmental toxins would play into that, and you often see those in the lower socioeconomic environment.
Now, African Americans have a higher incidence of asthma. They have higher rates of hospitalizations, emergency room visits, mortality, dying from asthma attacks. Most things when it comes to asthma are worse in the African American population. And perhaps even, sadly, even worse than what African Americans experience is Puerto Ricans. Puerto Ricans have even a higher incidence of asthma than do African Americans. And it's thought that there may be a genetic component. But, sadly, there's very high rates of asthma. In places like in the Bronx, it's like one in four kids approximately have asthma. So it's super, super high. And it's thought that it could be due to a lot of air pollution. A lot of these kids are living in residences that are very close to the roadways, and there's a lot of truck traffic, and the windows are open, and the air pollution is bad. And then they're exposed to indoor allergens like, mice and cockroaches, and there's, droppings all over the residence, and so we see very, very high rates in lower socioeconomic groups, and sadly those are the ones that at many times have the least access to care, and at times their formulary is restricted, And so we can't prescribe the medications that we want to because the formulary says, no, you can't use this drug, you have to use that drug. So it's a struggle to treat those who sort of have low insurance, have poor insurance, because there's just so many restrictions. The insurance company won't pay for this, that, and the other. And sadly, I mean, these patients are struggling to put food on the table. They don't have money to go out and buy these medications on their own, which are just a fortune as they are. I mean, even with copays, the medications are a small fortune.
Okay. How do food allergies work?
Food allergies usually don't trigger asthma unless the patient has underlying asthma. Let me give you a classic example. Somebody who, let's say, is allergic to shellfish, they will go out and, let's say, eat some lobster, and within 15, 20 minutes, their throat gets itchy. Their blood pressure will start to go down, so they become lightheaded. They break out with hives. They wheeze. They get short of breath. And if they don't get to the emergency room real quickly, they could die. So these are sort of crescendo symptoms, life-threatening. They occur very, very quickly. Sort of like a – think of your classic patient having a bee sting allergic reaction. It happens quickly. It's fast. And if you don't intervene quickly, your patient could die. So food allergy rarely causes just – you know, isolated. Let me put it the other way. An asthmatic patient who happens to be food allergic, they usually don't have any problems with their asthma if they stay away from the food that they're allergic to.
Going back to what Dr. Holyfield said with the low class and the environment having a big part with asthma, would you say that businesses who put their factories near the low class neighborhoods in mostly the general area where low-class people are, would that cause?
Oh, yes, and that's documented in the literature. So we know that people with asthma who live near highly trafficked roads, so if, let's say, you live near an interstate and there's a lot of truck traffic, you know, in and out 24 hours a day.
Or a coal plant.
Or a biomass plant. Or any source of air pollution. You know, not only can it trigger an asthma attack, just like, you know, cigarette smoke can, but it's also thought that a child living nearby a heavily trafficked road, they're at risk for developing asthma. So not only does it cause asthma attacks and those with pre-existing asthma, but it may actually cause asthma. All these diesel exhaust particles coming from cars, you know, they have metals attached to them, and they get into the lungs, and they're just horribly toxic, and they set up all kinds of inflammation in the lungs. So, you know, this has been studied, especially in Southern California, where there's a lot of traffic pollution. And what it's been shown there is that the kids who live nearby roads where there's a lot of traffic, what happens is all that pollution stunts their lung growth. So their lungs don't grow and mature into healthy adult lungs. So what happens is they have stunted lung growth. They eventually reach adulthood. Their lung function is down. And we know that decreased lung function is a risk factor for an earlier death. So there's no catch-up growth in adulthood. The lungs are stunted, and that person is predisposed to dying at an earlier age because of a decreased lung function brought on by exposure to pollution at a very young age. So this is a huge problem. I remember recently I was in New York, and I was I was walking by a school, and the school you can stand by the school and you could take a penny and you can throw it into the interstate. Just cars were whipping by, I mean, within just a couple of meters of the school. And so I was thinking about all these poor asthmatic kids that are in there and they're exposed to all these high levels of pollution. And it's just a shame that schools are situated in areas where there is pollution. And, you know, it would be so much better if society could, you know, realize that schools should be sort of protected areas. Schools should only be placed in areas where it's clean, there's limited air pollution. And it's really putting such a tremendous strain on the healthcare system by having schools and for that matter, residences, people with living in homes, nobody should be exposed to air pollution. I mean, no matter how you look at it, no matter where the person is, school, home, work, really doesn't matter actually. People shouldn't be exposed to air pollution because it kills people. And it kills people, causes asthma attacks, it causes cancer, all kinds of cancer. Huge problem in society. And, many of us are trying to decrease air pollution by talking to legislators, and it's an uphill battle.
Does living in the South play a big role in getting asthma or allergies?
Well, asthma, we see asthma all around the world, and we see it in the South. We see it up north. Where we see less of it actually is in Africa, in the rural parts of Africa. And it's thought that because of sort of a cleaner environment, less exposure to pollutants and irritants and carcinogens, that they have and perhaps through their diet they eat, you know, healthier, that there's a much lower incidence of asthma in very rural parts of Africa.
Dr. Saf, are there, alternative complementary medical practices that are recognized that are effective? I mean, I'm thinking of acupuncture, homeopathy, that work with asthma and allergies.
That has been looked at, and so far there really is nothing that has really panned out. Acupuncture has been looked at. It doesn't work. Chiropractic has been worked out, manipulating the back, manipulating the spine. That doesn't work. The herbals probably cause more problems with asthma than they solve, and they have all kinds of side effects. And so those sort of secondary or complementary types of treatments just haven't panned out. I know in the medical literature, physicians and scientists are sort of looking for all kinds of medications or herbals that can be helpful. I know in development, there's this medication that is being developed. It's not out yet. It's an early phase clinical development. But what it is, it's Chinese herbs, and it's a concoction of Chinese herbs. And that's being looked at by some pharmaceutical companies to see if it works. But it's too early to tell now.
Does living in a higher or lower populated area have anything to do with getting or having asthma?
The key thing is not sort of high population or low population. I think the key would be what comes in that environment. Is it a clean environment or is it dirty? Is it a relatively affluent area where people can afford medications, where there's health care? So I think it's not so much population, it's these other things. Access to health care, access to medications, parents that ensure that the child takes their medications. So there's other things that play a more important role, I think.
Probably one more question.
What was your education like?
College for 4 years, then medical school for 4 years. Then after that, I did 3 years of an internal medicine residency training. So I was in Philadelphia, and I trained in internal medicine. So I'm an internist by training. And then I did 2 years of what we call fellowship training in allergy. So I just learned allergy and asthma from a specialty training program, and I did that in Milwaukee. So essentially 4 years of medical school and 3 years post-medical school, and then 2 years of specialty training.
Well, when we're having a good time, it's gone, okay? you know, I just want to, again, extend my sincere appreciation to Dr. Ron's staff for coming. We really appreciate it. And to the students from the Millicent Hollifield Health Academy at Rickert High School. To my listening audience, tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. This edition of 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Hollifield. Technical assistant, Ken Smith. Audio copies are available, and if you want to participate in 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. If you would like to subscribe to 411 Team podcast, log in wfsu.org. Check us out on Facebook.